today's episode of Backpacker Radio, I am joined by recent Western States 100 winner Claire Gallagher. Not only is Claire a world-class ultra runner, she's also a very vocal and passionate environmental activist, Princeton graduate, Patagonia athlete, and all-around powerhouse. She shares how she was able to pull off the most important victory in her young ultra running career, the 2 weeks she spent hanging out with Tommy Caldwell in the Arctic leading up to the race, all the while doing everything she can to save the world. Literally. I touch briefly on my hike of the Oregon Coast Trail. We have a Trek propaganda featuring how to thru-hike as a petite woman, and much more. Claire is an exceptionally inspiring person, and I hope this episode delivers a healthy dose of this inspiration. But first, if you've listened to Backpacker Radio, you know that both Chance and I are big fans of Gossamer Gear, manufacturers of lightweight backpacking gear and accessories. Their packs carry comfortably, their roomy shelters protect in harsh weather conditions, and their trekking poles are some of the lightest on the planet. Gossamer Gear is changing the perception of delicate, ultralight gear. Chance and I are both users of Gossamer Gear's packs and shelters. I use the Gorilla, their 40-liter pack, on the PCT, and will be using their new model on an upcoming hike in Colorado and in the Wind River High Route. I also use a handful of their accessories, such as the Lightflex hiking umbrella, which works for both sun and the rain, and the Hipster, their lightweight fanny pack. Chance is out on the AT right now, as you know, getting super chafed up and rocking Gossamer Gear's The One Shelter, which is both roomy and light, weighing in at less than 1.5 pounds. It's the one you need, as some have said. Listeners of Backpacker Radio can score an exclusive deal on Gossamer Gear products. Use discount code TREK15, that's TREK and the number 15, for 15% off your cart at gossamergear.com, which is only valid for a limited time. Get it. And of course, we want to give a thank you to Sawyer Products. It's full-fledged tick season, so today I want to remind you about Sawyer's permethrin fabric treatment, which is highly effective against deer ticks. Unfortunately, Lyme disease is all too common in the United States, especially in the Mid-Atlantic and New England regions. Lyme disease can cause an assortment of health issues, including arthritis, facial palsy, dizziness, nerve pain, and a host of neurological issues. When a tick comes in contact with a fabric treated with permethrin, the fucker will either be repelled or hopefully murdered. Sawyer's permethrin fabric treatment is an odorless after-drying fabric treatment that does not harm any fabrics or finishes. It repels and kills mosquitoes and ticks for 6 weeks or 6 washes. It can be used to treat clothing, footwear, workwear, bibs, canvases, workstations, seat covers, dog beds, hammocks, chairs, tents, camping gear, mosquito netting, nets, outside of sleeping bags, backpacks, ground cloths, and other fabrics. It can be applied directly to dogs for protection from mosquitoes and fleas for 35 days and from ticks for 6 weeks. Official application instructions at sawyer.com/dogs. You can find Sawyer's permethrin fabric treatment at your local outfitter, REI, or at sawyer.com. Okay, let's do this. To Backpacker Radio, presented by The Trek. I am your host, Zach Badger Davis. We're going to get to our interview with Claire Gallagher in a minute. Before we do, I've had a handful of people reach out asking if I was going to talk about my most recent hike on the Oregon Coast Trail, and yes, I am. Here it is. As you may remember in previous episodes, I talked about my intention to thru-hike the Tahoe Rim Trail this year. Well, that was drafted up before we got to see what the Sierra was going to do this winter, which, as you now know, was dump a shit ton of snow. This was a hike I was doing with my good friend, Chris, who loves backpacking but doesn't have a ton of experience. We also had a very firm time constraint of just 8 days at the end of June, so we agreed that we'd prefer to not spend our free week of backpacking negotiating snow. There were a surprising lack of non-snow-packed backpacking options out west for this time of the year, and the Oregon Coast Trail seemed like our best bet given our timing and what we were looking for. And damn am I glad that we found it. The hike was amazing. we were only able to cover about 110 miles of the trail, starting at the northern terminus, in our 6 days of hiking, so roughly just the first quarter of the trail. So I can't speak to the full experience, but what I can say is that I enjoyed what we did so much that I fully intend to knock out the remaining miles in the next couple of years. First and foremost, the Oregon coast is gorgeous. Whether you get out to hike this trail or just to visit, you should. I had been to Cannon Beach once a decade ago on an overcast day, so I was more or less ignorant to the incredible beauty of this area. For the stretch that we did, you're either hiking on the beach or when the Cape juts out into the ocean, you go up and over through lush rainforest. Ocean and rainforest are both exotic to me. I live in Colorado, so perhaps those who've spent a lot of time on the beach or in the Pacific Northwest, you might not be as excited by the terrain, but I was in heaven every day. Another unique aspect was the access to town. For some, this will be a plus. For some, this will be a minus. For us, we really enjoyed it. You go through at least one town every day, again, just through this stretch, and oftentimes multiple towns. If you're looking for a purely wilderness hike, this is not it, though I've been told the southern half of the hike is far more remote. But we went into the OCT well aware of this fact and adjusted our expectations accordingly. And by that, I mean we were taking full advantage of the access to amazing beer and fish and chips every day. So maybe not the best hike if you're looking to stretch your dollar as far as possible, but we really enjoyed it. And on that note, the camping is much more restrained than other trails. For the entire stretch of trail that we did, you're more or less required to camp at state parks. The cost is only $8 per night for the hiker and biker spots and includes running water, a shower, lockers, and many of the lockers have USB inputs to charge your devices, #2019. Again, this might not be your cup of tea, but we enjoyed the amenities and the parks were gorgeous, really well maintained. It honestly surpassed our expectations. The primary thing I didn't love was the road walking. There are a handful of stretches which require road walks and a couple where the official trail is the road, where there are alternatives to hop on a ferry and continue hiking the beach. So every time we were dumped onto a busy road, we hitched, and that's what I would do again and will do again if that's what it requires for the remaining part of the trail. Anytime that we had the option to stay on the beach and continue hiking, we obviously did that. The problem with the alternates are oftentimes they require a ferry, which can be weather dependent and also requires a fee. I think the two rides that we did were $10 and $20 per person. And in one spot, the guide suggested taking a boat hitch in an area where there were no boats. So flexibility is key, as is true with all good backpacking trips. Even with those oddities, we both loved the experience, and I can't wait to get back out and finish what I started. I do hope to get a post out on the trek about this hike when my schedule clears a little bit later this summer, but in the meantime, you can check out my photos on Instagram at ZRDavis. And one quick funny story, we were at a trailhead, there was a guy there doing a little bit of trail magic, passing out some beers, chatted us up a little bit, told us about all the hiking adventures he had done over the previous month, and that he mentioned that he had come from the PCT to the Oregon Coast Trail because he had heard of it on this podcast, and then proceeded to ask me and my friend if either of us had ever heard of Backpacker Radio or Zach Davis. His face turned pretty red when I told him who I was. We both got a big kick out of that. Okay, to our main event. Today's interview is with Claire Gallagher. In a nutshell, Claire is a supernova. She's a world-class ultra runner, having just won the Western States 100, despite taking an impromptu trip to the Arctic right before her run. She's a passionate and vocal environmental activist, which you will learn early and often from our chat, a graduate at Princeton, and honestly, as nice as can be. I hope you enjoy our chat as much as I did. Here it is. Okay, I'm sitting down at Claire Gallagher's apartment on a very comfortable couch. Well, first and foremost, thank you so much for having me here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Zach.
So I want to start at the beginning. How did you first get into ultra running?
I first got into ultra running. I was living in southern Thailand teaching English. And I had just graduated college, and I had been running track, you know, so the longest distance I did was a 10K on the track. And I kind of was like falling out of love with running. And then when I found myself with nothing else to do in this tiny fishing village near Phuket, Thailand, I started running again, as one does. And I signed up for a 50 miler in northern Thailand, kind of on a whim, and had no idea what to expect. And So I went up there like 6 months after essentially I was done with collegiate track for this first ultra race with some friends. We were like backpacking along the way, and it just completely blew my mind away. Yeah. Like I hallucinated in this race. I fell in love with like how much like fueling has to do with it. Uh-huh. You know, I was eating like sticky rice sweets during this race and just like being so like, I don't know, so like swallowed by the land. Mm. You know, it's, I feel like ultras, you're really a part of the landscape. And in this place in particular, in the Golden Triangle, it's like, oh, just the most beautiful hill tribe, like villages with agricultural rice fields you can imagine.
Mm. What was the longest distance you had run prior to that point? Because you mentioned that the longest you'd done in college was a 10K.
Yeah.
To go to 50 miles is an enormous jump.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I didn't even race the 10K. It was actually a steeplechaser, which is a 3K on the track. So just like under 2 miles.
Yeah.
You know, really fast track race. Yeah, I hadn't run anything longer than a 10K. I mean, the long runs we would do on the weekends in college were like max 14 miles.
Wow.
So yeah, I got like a, basically I downloaded like a rough training plan when I like had Wi-Fi in like intermittent chunks when I was in Thailand. I was like, okay, like Google how to run an ultra. And I actually came upon Chrissy Mail, who's I'm now like teammates with. She's a Patagonia ambassador. She wrote this amazing book, How to Run Your First Ultra. And I sort of followed one of those plans.
Gotcha. Yeah. So the 14 miles wasn't the longest run that you'd done prior to the 50 miler. You had...
Yeah, no, I took training like somewhat seriously. Gotcha. Just because I knew I'd injure myself.
Yeah.
And the longest run I did in Thailand leading up to that ultra was 6 hours. So, and I have no idea how long it was.
Yeah.
I didn't have a smartwatch at the time. So I just went by time. Uh-huh. And it was like a super long 6 hours. And I would basically run and these like rubber tree plantations from different areas to different areas, stopping at little gas stations along the way for my fuel. it's I don't know, imagine like a really rural area with very few amenities.
Yeah.
And so yeah, I actually look back to that time really fondly.
Sure, that sounds like fun.
Yeah.
How did you do in the race?
Well, there were 44 people who started, I'm pretty sure, and like 20 finished. Two women finished. I won.
You won.
Yeah. And I forget what I was overall, maybe like fourth or something or fifth.
Did you have any expectation to win the race?
I don't even know.
You don't have to be humble here.
Yeah. I mean, it was such a niche race. Like, even though I was coming in out of nowhere to the ultra running scene, like I knew it's not this like a world-class field or anything. But yeah, the race has happened once since, and hopefully it'll happen again. It's definitely not like a highly sponsored ultra marathon, but if it happens again, man, I highly encourage people to go. It's called a Thailand Mountain Ultra Marathon.
Okay.
It's like just so core ultra where like there's no fanfare, there's no big corporate sponsors, there's no prize money. You're there purely like to suffer and also be really psyched to be in the community.
Uh-huh. How common is it for someone to excel at the 2 mile race distance and also the 50 or 100 mile race distance? So it seemed like, I don't know much,
yeah,
but those seem like different skill sets to me.
Oh, for sure. Well, I actually didn't excel that much in college. So even though I ran like Division I ran at Princeton, which has a decent distance program as far as collegiate running goes. I never like made it to nationals or anything. For listeners, that's like, I don't know, for a college runner to make it to nationals, that means you're like pretty legit. And I never was at that level. But like, granted, I was still recruited to run in college. And then, but the success I've had in ultra running is quite different. Like they're basically different sports.
Yeah. Okay. Like, that confirms what I would have guessed. Yeah. So it's good.
Even
to hear
like
that.
A road marathon, you know, you see Olympians and doing road marathons, or just even, you know, your buddy running the Denver Marathon or Chicago Marathon. It's close to a different sport than like a 50 or 100 mile ultra.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Did you grow up running? Were you running as a kid?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, I played a lot of sports. I played lacrosse and swam and soccer and lots of things in suburban Denver. But I also like grew up hiking in the mountains. And so it's a really cool mixture of sort of mountain exploration with, with like few parameters or boundaries. You know, my dad would just like drag me up 14ers and I kind of hated it. And then you have the like very structured, like high school track and cross country. Like those were my two worlds. And then now since I've gotten into ultra running, it's like this really, really cool combination of those two worlds.
So do you come from ultra genetics? It sounds like your parents, or at least your dad, had a proficiency for getting in the mountains.
Yeah, he's a very proficient mountain person. But no, neither of my parents are ultra athletes. But like my mom ran in college at Bowdoin. And my parents are both lifelong runners. But they both think I'm pretty crazy.
Yeah. 100 miles is my definition of crazy, so I agree with that. So correct me if I'm wrong, your first 100 mile race was the Leadville 100?
Yep.
How'd you do in that?
Yeah, that it was a great day. I won that race. and yeah, it was pretty weird because I went in super naive, like pretty much as green as you can go into a 100 mile race. And so for me to have such success, and I laugh now because it's still like kind of unbelievable. I had only moved to Boulder back from Asia, like in January of 2016, and Leadville happens in August. I basically had that time period to just immerse myself in like this really like trail running culture that Boulder is. And it just seemed like all these people around me, my trail group, Rocky Mountain Runners, they're all like signing up for 100 milers. And I was like, oh, why don't I do that?
Yeah.
And little did I know that it was like kind of ludicrous for me to think I would have any success that early on in my trail running experience.
Yeah. So did you have any expectation to win that race?
Well, I did run a few shorter races that summer, trail races like a 50K and a 30K. And I knew I was in really, really good shape. And I was able to run pretty well at high altitudes. I just was spending every weekend in the mountains running with mostly guys who were faster than me. And I think it was my friend, one of my friends, Cassie, before a couple weeks before Leadville. And she was like, you know, you could do really well at this. And I was like, okay, well, maybe I'll shoot for podium, whatever that means.
So that's just top three?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And, but then when I made my race plan, I picked the top times from the last, like, essentially since the race has begun. And that's what I made my A time goals based on.
Did you beat your goal, the goal time?
Yeah,
that you're
trying to... Yeah, I think my goal time was 19:30. And again, that's just me being so naive. Like,
yeah.
Looking at it now, what I know about ultra running, like that would be the equivalent of someone basically being like, oh, I'm going to do the CDT this summer. And you choose like the fastest time.
Thank you for using the thru hiking analogy.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I ended up with the second fastest time ever, which was 19 hours. So again, it's just like
aim for the stars, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's wild. So the first race that you'd ever done, or the first long ultra that you'd ever done, was the one in Thailand, which there, you know, there's not a ton of fanfare, not sponsorship or anything like that. The Leadville is very much more in that direction.
Yeah.
How did you feel about the culture swing from the first one that you mentioned was very pure to something that, you know, has a little bit more of like a competitive aspect to it?
Yeah. Honestly, it felt natural. Like, you know, I wasn't naive to the fact that like trail running is a bona fide sport and really popular, especially in Colorado. I honestly didn't realize how big of a deal Leadville was until after I won it. So I'm like, geez, everyone seems to care that I won Leadville. This is kind of weird. And then since then, you know, I've learned like what a machine it is. And I mean, it's really is in some ways a corporate ultra race, which is not like every race. And I definitely like to do a lot of the more backyard ones as well. But the history surrounding Leadville, yeah, I honestly can't speak highly enough about it. I really do want to see them go cupless, though. I will say that.
Cupless?
Yeah, yeah. If anyone's planning on running a Leadville event from the marathon or to the 100, I encourage everyone to bring their own cups. Like a little, I don't know if you bring these through hiking, you know, like a little reusable cup that has kind of its own structure, but you can fold it up and shove it in your pack. I can show
you. Like a soft shell water bladder. Yeah.
Yeah.
You are seeing more of that. What is common in the thru hiking community is to get a smart water bottle and then use that for 150 miles or so.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. And so you guys like do zero waste so well, right?
Yeah.
Like unless
aside from all the trash of all the garbage food that we're eating
at a like a gas station or something. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. But in a trail race, like there's no excuse to not just be using your own cup. You're going into aid stations. You can just have these amazing volunteers fill up your cup with, you know, Coke or water or whatever versus using single use cups. And yeah, I think any legit race these days should be cupless. I just ran Western States a week ago and that, I mean, that's really like the Super Bowl of ultra running. And, yeah, they were cupless this year. It was awesome to see. Yeah.
So do they provide their own reusable or is it just expected that people bring their own?
They provided some, but like, you know, you don't take one if you already have one.
Right.
You know, I have like four.
Yeah.
I'm not going to take another one.
Sure.
And then at aid stations they have, plastic cups that they're quote community cups use at your own risk and then they just get washed throughout the race. You know, these aid station volunteers are filling up with Coke, someone chugs it, they wash it and fill it up again.
Thru hikers would have no problem with that. We're eating trash off the ground,
eating stuff
out of dumpsters, so sharing a cup is not
you're
not getting any rolled eyes of that one. So, okay, I did look through your running resume a bit. I also saw that you won the Ultra Trail du Mont Blanc. Did I say that correctly?
I won the 100K version of it.
The 100K version of that. Okay. So my wife and I are actually looking to do the full version of that next year.
Oh, awesome. The TMB.
Yeah. And we're looking to take about a week for that.
Mm-hmm.
What was your time?
Just over 12 hours. Yeah. So, well, that's the last 60 miles of it.
Okay.
So, the winning times of UTMB, which is the full 100 miles around Mont Blanc. And for listeners, it's a mountain that sits on the board, basically the crosshairs of France, Italy, and Switzerland. The winning times of that race are like low 20 hours. Oof. Yeah. It's pretty gnarly.
Yeah. Just selfishly stoke my own hype for this. How was that run or that scenery?
Oh, it's so insane. Yeah. I mean, I have a soft spot in my heart for Colorado. I'm just obsessed with sort of the round high mountains here. But when you're running in the Alps, you're just like, there couldn't be a more beautiful place on earth.
Yeah.
Just the sheer cliffs and the glaciers. The glaciers are really unique. And running there now at like this time in, I don't know, earth is pretty, it's almost emotional in a way because you see these glaciers melting and you see like rock fall becoming more common. And that's, I've been there for the past, I guess, two summers. And yeah, you just see the earth changing firsthand. I think it's the closest witness I've seen of climate change firsthand running around the Alps. Yeah.
Interesting.
So, just take notes, you know, take photos because it won't be the same.
Yeah.
50 years.
And I mean, listeners are already gathering your passion and enthusiasm for environmental activism. And I have a whole section of questions for that. So we'll get, no, but honestly, like interject that at any point that is relevant because I think that's great. And I think you're speaking on, ears that will accept that well.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that I thought was interesting is you have celiac disease.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also a vegetarian.
Yeah.
That's a pretty restricted diet. How do you, with all the endurance sports that you do, how do you, I guess just walk us through like what your daily diet looks like. I'll say on a non-race day.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, and a celiac, for people who don't know, is a genetic, disease of sorts. So I've known since I was 15. So it's been over a decade, like most of my life. I've not consume gluten, and I never was able to like digest gluten. Like I was kind of a sickly child, like chronically anemic, low on iron, because because like my body just can't digest gluten. So it's honestly really easy. Like being a celiac is like super chill, especially nowadays living in Boulder, you know, everyone's gluten intolerant. And I have no problem with people who don't want to put gluten in their body. It makes it cheaper for the rest of us.
Right.
You
know? Yeah.
So I eat a ton of rice, corn, tortillas. And yeah, being a vegetarian is also super easy. I eat for breakfast, usually like oatmeal or cereal.
I was witness to that.
Flaxseed. Yeah. Yeah. Just had my second breakfast. And then I often run like mid morning and then I'll get home and eat eggs, spinach, tortillas, rice, maybe veggies. And I usually eat about the same thing for dinner with beans, hummus, for protein. Yeah, it's pretty simple.
Do you supplement with anything?
I take vitamin C and iron because I've been chronically anemic, and probiotic, and what else do I take? Calcium gummies when I remember and vitamin D when I remember. So yeah, I actually, in a way, it seems like I might take a lot of supplementary pills, but I get my blood tested pretty regularly, and that seemed to be really all I need. And I don't need B12, even. Granted, I eat eggs, but I make also a point to buy like the best eggs possible, like organic, free range.
Yeah.
You know, they're stupid expensive, but
yeah,
you know, the egg laying industry is absolutely atrocious. Like what these chickens go through to produce are really cheap dollar a dozen eggs.
Right.
So,
and you get great eggs at that Boulder Farmers Market as well.
Yeah. Yeah, my diet's pretty simple. That being said, I travel quite a bit.
Yeah.
And like when I'm on road trips, I eat a lot of junk. And
I was gonna say, cause I'm also gluten free. I'm not celiac, but I'm gluten sensitive.
Nice.
I can definitely notice a difference. Not anything. I don't want to put myself in the same conversation as celiac, but.
Oh, I don't care.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's like, I just wonder if people who are celiac roll their eyes at people who are like,
you know,
I get kind of bloated when
Well, totally. It's like everyone should be entitled to like make themselves feel like
good
and like put the right things in your body.
Good.
Yeah.
But I do find traveling to be very it's difficult to find non-wheat products when you're, you know, on the road.
Totally.
I do find there are times where I have to accidentally intermittent fast because there's not any good options, or I just cheat and feel like garbage. But
yeah,
I'm wondering, someone who's like a high octane athlete, how do you handle that?
Honestly, I've like starved when I've been in Europe on trips before.
Yeah,
and
sure.
It's been like in places in Italy, I've just been like, oh my gosh, I am so hungry. And so I'll just like end up eating meat if, you know, because that's like an easy thing that I don't have to restrict when I'm in Europe. But I don't know. Like, you can always find produce usually, or I just bring food with me. Like, I was just in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for 2 weeks eating all dehydrated food, you know, Patagonian provisions basically for 2 weeks. So my body's able to handle, I guess, like packaged food for a while. Which is very useful when it comes to ultra running. And I'm sure you find the same in through hiking. Like, it's almost better to not have like a really strict diet in terms of like when you're eating the same thing every day.
Right.
Like, that can be useful, but it's also useful to have like keep your body guessing.
Right. You become too accustomed to anything. And like, if you deviate from that, it can create problems, to say the least.
And like, as a vegetarian celiac, I find that I can do that.
Yeah. So how many calories do you aim for, both like in like that a normal day and on a race day?
Oh, I have no idea how many calories I eat on a normal day.
Do you aim for a certain amount of meals, or like, is there any general pattern, or is it just you eat when you're hungry?
Yeah, I pretty much just eat when I'm hungry.
Okay. It's amazing. Because the other, I talked to Courtney Dahlwalter about her diet as well.
Yeah.
And like, she's obviously a phenomenal high octane athlete, and she's kind of the same way. She's like, it's not scientific whatsoever.
Yeah.
It's just like,
oh, she's such a homie. Yeah, she's great. And I think, I would say we probably aren't the norm, but
then
still
again, kicking everyone's ass.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, there are some ultra runners who live more like a road runner, which is pretty like regimented and and yeah, I mean, to be good at road running, you kind of have to live like a monk in a lot of people's opinions. And I'm sure there are ultra
runners. Why is that different out of curiosity?
Like the, I don't know, to excel, well, at say a road marathon, you just have to be so, so dialed. You can't have any injuries, and like your body's not going through the stuff we're going through on the trails, like sleep deprivation and like, you know, the threat of spraining an ankle and like crazy ups and downs. Like you're basically an F1, you know, like car racer versus like, I don't know, someone driving a, like a truck on mountains. And you know, the courses are so predictable. So thus it follows your lifestyle can be more predictable and dialed. Yeah, you could ask. I mean, if you just even Google like any road runner and look at their schedule, it's crazy how regimented they are. Yeah.
So there are no road runners out there that are successful that follow the more laid back.
I'm sure there are. Okay. Like for there definitely are. But yeah, even like
it's not the cultural norm.
Yeah, exactly. You look at Des Linden, who won Boston last year. She's this like American sweetheart, you know, she's, but she's also known for being kind of spunky and, you know, she like drinks and things and is like funny on Twitter about that. But then you like really look at her schedule and it's like, she's running twice a day. She's so dialed. She's getting this much amount of sleep every day, you know, and then you take the average ultra runner and it's like, no way.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So what, how about during races? Do you have
It's pretty common. You need to get like 200 to 300 calories in an hour.
Okay.
Yeah. So I do that by basically two gels, which are each roughly 100 calories. And then I'm also drinking Coca-Cola.
I feel like the carbonation would make it, make you too belchy.
Yeah, it's actually really useful. Like I prefer carbonation. In order to like keep things moving.
Okay.
Because you can get like kind of really bloated when you're ultra running, and so like burping can sometimes be the most like amazing relief of your day.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, Coca-Cola is a huge craving amongst thru hikers too. And maybe there's some nutritional aspect like you're describing. I just assumed it was gluttony, but and I'm not throwing.
Well, you have sugar and caffeine.
Right.
And then, you know, if you want the carbonation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that ends up being over 200 calories an hour.
Do you have a favorite guilty pleasure, whether during race or just like a given day? Is it even a guilty pleasure when you run as much as you do?
Yeah, no, that's, it's really nice. I don't actually think too much about my diet, and at least like not in the way I did in college, which I think like breeds a really unhealthy relationship with food, where people are just like trying to ride this edge of like basically being fit and I don't know, light, you know, and in ultra running, you like can't get away with it. Because you'll get injured, like if you're too light. And so you kind of have to eat everything, or at least have a really healthy relationship with food, or else you won't stick around in the sport. So yeah, I've never, it's been very freeing to be in this sport.
That's definitely a crossover with thru hiking as well. It's almost impossible to eat too much food. And the, the one thing I see people making mistakes on is not eating enough. And especially in the beginning stages, relying on their hunger too much. They'll get tired and beaten down, and they're not, because they're putting, they're exerting their bodies so much that they don't ever get to the point of being hungry. And then they just start to break down. I'm always like, just eat until it feels uncomfortable and then keep walking.
Yeah, that slow fuse. That's the same. In ultra running, it's the same. It's just like a little faster speed hiking, right? And I'm not hungry an hour into an ultra race, but I have to force myself to eat two gels.
This is interesting. You set the women's supported FKT for the Joshua Tree Traverse, which is 37 miles across Joshua Tree National Park. Talk about that. This is not something I was aware of.
Oh yeah. So basically in ultra running, there's all of these routes that, you know, someone has come up with, and then thanks to these amazing guys, they're actually in Boulder, named Buzz Burrell and Peter Bachwin. And this covers thru hiking, the fastest known time database, right?
It's huge in our sport.
So it's the, this database of fastest known times. And well, actually, I needed an excuse to go to Joshua Tree to visit Alistair.
Who's, make it a work trip. Yeah, smart.
He's sitting over here. Say hi, Alistair.
Hey, backpackers.
He knows his audience.
Yeah. Alistair was climbing in Joshua Tree, and I was like, oh, I need to do heat training for Western States. And I just looked up. I was like, oh, sweet. There's a fastest known time traverse that's 37 miles. This would be perfect. And it's going to be super hot. I'll just go there. And that was my excuse of going there, even though I was just trying to visit Alistair.
Yeah. So how long, 37 miles, how long did that take?
It was like just under, no, 5 hours? 4:52. No, I think that's the men's FKT. And I think, oh, I did run 4:52. Yeah, I ran 4:52. Yeah, yeah, I missed the men's FKT by like 2 minutes, which is hilarious.
No. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No offense to the men's FKT holder, but it definitely can be brought down.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any intentions of doing it?
Again?
Yeah.
Not anytime soon.
Okay.
Yeah, Joshua Tree is pretty inhospitable now.
Yeah, sounds like
July.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
So are you following, is it a route? Is it trail?
Oh, it's this amazing route. It's called the California Riding and Hiking Trail, I'm pretty sure. And so people go to Joshua Tree to go to the like really popular campsites and these cool rock formations, which are wildly popular. Like mm-hmm. you'll see cars lined up all over the place. But on this trail, I saw like six people the entire day, just because it cuts across the park in a place that's not well traveled. Like just the trail itself is not that frequently traveled by, you know, your average visitor from LA. So it was just magical. It goes through these two desert ecosystems, the Mojave, which is higher, it's above 3,000 feet, and then it gets down into the Colorado desert ecosystem. Just two otherworldly places, like just these flowers and lava rocks, and it's hot. It was just like totally, I loved it because ultra running, I feel like, can almost be snobby. About being like so focused on mountains, you know, like, oh, well, where are you? In Colorado and Utah or California. But this is the desert and it is a world-class single track trail.
Yeah.
That like ultra runners through hikers highly recommend it. I saw a handful of backpackers.
Interesting.
So you could do it in, 2 days.
Yeah.
Backpacking.
What month was this?
I did it in May.
Is that the ideal time or is that a little bit later?
It's pretty hot.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah.
I guess you're doing it specifically to heat train, you mentioned. So what is the hottest temperature that you saw while you were out there?
I'm guessing 80, 85. Yeah. Fahrenheit.
And is that representative of what you saw in Western States?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it worked out nicely.
Honestly, I think I was more hot in Joshua Tree. Huh. I mean, there's no shade.
Yeah.
Literally no shade. Huh. And I didn't have aid stations like I had in Western States. I only saw my crew twice. So my pack was a little bit heavier. Mm-hmm. It was awesome. Like, I'm so grateful Alistair was climbing there and I needed an excuse to go visit him because it really ended up paying off for Western States.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you only saw your aid station twice, do you feel like you want to go after the unsupported record sometime? Because it sounds like you were almost on that cusp.
Yeah.
Like, or been there, done that.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, there's so many trails to do. I could totally see myself going back in the winter because I really love being in hot places. So so yeah, I would honestly do it again in a heartbeat. I would also do it not sprinting.
Sure.
Like, I was working really hard for those 5 hours.
Any plans for future FKTs?
Yeah. Oh, I'm always looking at maps, like constantly. There's so many in Colorado that are like really big and intimidating. I have no plans actually as of yet this year, but like things that excite me. I mean, the CT is one of them. Like, I've never challenged myself on a multi-day effort. And so the Colorado Trail would be cool, even just to do, not in the fastest time, which I think the women's record is 9 days.
Okay. Is that the supported or self-supported?
Supported.
Okay.
Yeah. Men's is around 8 days, I'm pretty sure.
It is a beautiful trail.
Yeah.
It gives you a great display of what Colorado has to offer. Okay. So I think probably the big news item for you of late, obviously, is your Western States 100 win.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost, congratulations.
Thanks.
Yeah. So I think you mentioned this earlier. I'm, again, ignorant to the ultra scene. Is the Western States is considered, you said, the Super Bowl of ultra. Why is that?
It's the oldest 100-mile race in the U.S., and it just, year after year since it started, which has been, it's been decades now, brings really, really top competition, mm-hmm. international competition. So, and the structure, they're just brilliant. The race people who've, the race board that's decided this structure brings the top 10 men and women back every year. You get an entry in, an automatic entry. And then they have this qualifying system in the spring leading up to the race, where if you get top two in a golden ticket race, you get an entry in. So that means there's every year basically like 20, at least 20, like world class ultra runners from each gender in the pool.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which no other race has that type of depth of field.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're like, and out of that 20, it's like some years 10 men and women could be in it for the winning,
mm-hmm.
you know, where it's like just so competitive.
Yeah.
Do
you describe yourself as a very competitive person? Are you competitive with yourself? Are you competitive against the field? How do you?
Yeah, I think I've really changed as a runner in the last few years. I think maybe a few years ago, I'd describe myself just as like really basically competitive, like across the board. But especially ever since I've been with Patagonia, which is this amazing company that doesn't, you know, push me to race like out of my league or just, it doesn't really care about racing. Like it has a bigger purpose. And I feel like I've adopted that in my own racing. Like I only race because I want to and not because anyone's paying me or I have to do it for any sponsor. And so that made like Western States this year so freeing. Like I was there completely on my own volition, just so psyched to have my crew there. And then, you know, I'm running for something bigger than myself, honestly. Like I had just come back from the Arctic Refuge and like that to me is a lot, you know, talking about the Arctic Refuge is a lot more important than talking about winning a race, but it allows me to have this platform. So
yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a unique way to think about racing, and I hope I don't lose it because I like feel really psyched about it right now.
So you're not the type, you're not flipping a Monopoly board if you land on jail too many times? Or...
Yeah, no, okay. I mean.
I am. So you've mentioned it a couple of times now, the 2-week trip to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Mm-hmm.
You were there with Tommy Caldwell.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. That sounds incredible.
Yeah. So for people who don't know who Tommy Caldwell is, you should just Google him.
Yeah. And see The Dawn Wall.
Yeah.
Which is one of the best movies I've seen in years.
I completely agree. Yeah. He's such an inspiring person, let alone climber. And so basically at the beginning of June, I get a call from him and he was like, hey, I'm going to go to this climate summit in Fort Yukon, Alaska, which is, home to Gwich'in people, which is one of native tribes in America and Canada. And then he's like, then I'm going to the Arctic Refuge for an expedition. Hmm. And he pitched it as a running expedition. And I'm like, oh yeah, this will be a perfect like taper before Western States. And
does Tommy run?
Yeah. He'll tell you he doesn't, but he totally runs.
Okay.
He's actually like, he's just such an insane athlete and he's such a sandbagger.
Yeah.
Like he'll be like, oh, I've just been on the couch for the past 2 months. And then and when we were in the refuge, he's just sprinting across scree fields and it looks like he's walking and he's carrying a 60-pound pack. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, I am so in out of my league.
That's funny. That's funny that you feel that way about him.
Oh yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely wasn't a running trip.
Yeah.
Like there was no running in the refuge. Cause it's just like such, it's amazingly complex terrain.
Yeah.
Like there's no trails in the Arctic Refuge. So basically, yeah, he pitched this trip. I couldn't say no. Going into this climate change summit led by the Gwich'in was one of the coolest experiences of my life. I'm in a kind of a really, I don't know, poignant way because the people living up in the Arctic Circle are experiencing climate change 2 to 3 times as severe as we are at lower latitudes. And these are the people who've been living off the land for millennia. Like, the Gwich'in is one of the most resilient tribes on planet Earth. They're Americans, they're Canadians. And as the Earth is warming, their food source, moose, caribou, geese, salmon, all of these populations are changing and the migrations are changing. So they can't reliably get food like they have in the past. And that's due to climate change. So it's a really basic food security issue. It's their culture, it's their life. And you know, they need people in DC and you and I and all listeners to, you know, step up. Like, they are literally going through a climate emergency as we speak, where like freezers are going empty in winters because, you know, people can't hunt moose because the moose aren't traveling in their normal patterns.
Yeah.
And then in the refuge, you know, it's this horrible, horrible prospect of drilling. And that's purely because of the Trump administration that has just steamrolled a provision in the 2017 tax bill to allow oil and gas leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which is untouched by humans. And that's where the porcupine caribou thrive. And that's the lifeline of the Gwich'in, because they hunt caribou. And yeah, if there were to be drilling there, like, for sure that would disrupt the caribou populations and the Gwich'in, like, as we know them. So there's going to be a vote in the House of Representatives this July, like any week now, to prevent the leases from actually being sold. So for all listeners, I just encourage you to Google Arctic Refuge Bill. It's actually, it's called HR 1146 is the number of the bill, because we need reps in the lower 48 to be standing up for this. You know, it's America. Like, Alaska is America.
Right.
We need to stand up for these people.
Yeah. So contact your local reps. Yeah. Give them hell.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty, like, it's so easy today to even just sign a petition. You know, if you Google it via Patagonia or Alaska Wilderness League. But way more impactful is if you just pick up the phone and actually dial your rep's number. And it's, like, not intimidating at all. It seems like it's intimidating and kind of awkward, but you basically dial it and you'll either get left to a voice message and you say, hey, please support HR 1146, or please support the Arctic Refuge. Or you talk to some aide who's like a 23-year-old who works for your representative in DC, who's just taking tick marks down for every issue.
Right.
And then they bring those back to the boss, you know?
Right. They just want to be reelected.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So just like keep on adding your tick marks.
Right. Yeah. I know there are a few services online that make it very easy to find your local representative. So we'll definitely include that in the show notes.
And I mean, I will say the Arctic Refuge is a through hiking paradise. Like, this is where it's at. And I honestly, it's a weird thing to, you know, encourage people to go to a place that's so untouched by humans, but we need to see these places in order to protect them. And especially the through hiking community is so, like, low impact and, you know, takes Leave No Trace really seriously. That's who we saw up there. It was backpackers, like really hardcore backpackers who get dropped in by a bush plane, and you can do it pretty cheaply. It seems expensive, but the bush plane is the biggest expense, and maybe you get a cash dropped along the way, and then you can get like a mail courier plane from one of the coastal towns. I mean, you can do epic, epic traverses, like from 10 days to 50 days. We saw a group doing a 50-day backpacking trip. Damn. Yeah.
Are you familiar with Andrew Skirka?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. He was on a previous episode.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Oh, okay. Maybe I saw that. So, of course, I'm in a hotel room or breakfast in Fairbanks when we were leaving, and Skirko was about to lead a trip into the Brooks Range. But I think in Gates of the Arctic.
So aside from the, obviously the importance of the environmental concerns that you saw out there, the timing of your being out there is kind of hilarious, because this is, would you consider the Western States the, like, your biggest run of the year?
For sure. It was basically my only race I cared about.
Yeah. So when was the proposition given to you in terms to go do this?
It was early June. So it was a month out from the race.
And you said you couldn't pass it up, but I think if you did pass it up, no one would, you know, question you whatsoever.
For sure. Yeah. No one would have questioned, I think, at least in the ultra running community.
Right.
Cause it's kind of like, it's almost like you know, race suicide in a way.
Yeah.
Like, oh, there goes your race. Like,
that's what I was going to say. So was it a difficult decision for you?
I spent about an hour. I actually was still in Joshua Tree. I was leaving Joshua Tree, driving on the, talking to Tommy. And then I just like kept on driving. I was like, man, I just like crushed this FKT. But I'm like, no, like, this is what life is about. Like, I just need to take this opportunity. I can always try and qualify for Western States a different year. Mm-hmm. But, you know, being active in the fight against climate change is something that's like really needed today.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about it for an hour.
An hour.
Yeah.
That's impressive, because obviously running is a huge part of your career.
Yeah.
And you said race suicide. Have you seen any of the Rocky movies?
Yeah.
I'm picturing like a Rocky montage, you being in the Arctic Circle. Like, were you pulling Tommy on a sled at anything?
Not exactly. They were kind of pulling me, but yeah.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to talk about with the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge trip?
No, I mean, I really encourage people to Google it and to contact their reps, and especially through hikers. Like, and it's changing every year. The permafrost is thawing. Like, now is the time to go. Well, not now, actually, the mosquitoes are out now, but
yeah.
Like June is kind of the prime month.
Yeah.
Andrew
mentioned that mosquito season in Alaska is probably the worst thing he's ever seen in his life. So have the right chemicals and or clothing if you're going to do that.
Yeah.
So I want to backtrack a little bit to the actual race itself.
Uh-huh.
Just talk about that. What was that experience like? Cause you said this is the biggest race of your career.
Yeah.
You won. What kind of euphoria is that?
Yeah. Well, it was pretty weird because I went in with very few expectations. Like, I just was so grateful to be on the starting line, relatively healthy. I mean, it was a small miracle, like coming out of the refuge, not super injured.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any injuries?
Yeah. I had like a kind of a bum Achilles. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was worried about that, you know, and taped it up and stuff. And then I was running behind Courtney Dawiter for 80 miles and just was like sitting pretty in my own little universe and just felt really strong and calm. And then, when Courtney dropped, unfortunately due to injury, then it was like the race of my life.
Hmm.
Like I really actually don't ever want to have to work as hard as I worked in those last 6 miles.
Yeah.
I said after I won in the like post-race interview that I completely blacked out, and I literally did. Like, I remember moments with Alistair who was pacing me, but it just was one of those things where like my body was pushed to such a limit. And this is all because, for listeners who don't know, the second place gal, Brittany Patterson, had caught me at mile 93. I thought I had the win in the bag, and I was like working really hard. I was like, there's no way she's gonna catch me. She caught me, and we ran together for a mile.
Huh.
In the
are you
pitch
communicating
black.
While that's happening?
Well, it's super awkward, right?
Right.
So she passed me definitively. Uh-huh. Like you do, and I was like, oh, good job, Brittany, you know. And then I just turned into this other.
Are you gritting your teeth and you're saying, good job, Brittany?
Yeah. Like, oh, for sure. I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah, exactly.
I was like, oh my gosh.
It's like your shoes untied.
Yeah.
I'm trying to do something to distract her.
Yeah. And it was kind of fortunately for me, it was on this uphill rocky section. So you couldn't really run it, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
I just like stuck to her pacer's heels for a mile. And I knew an aid station was coming up around mile 94. And I knew the fact that I was able to match her move, that I had more left in my tank. And then I just made this like really rash like decision at mile 94 aid station to not stop. I dropped all my excess weight in my pack. So I got rid of like, you know, my ice bandana and an extra soft flask and things. And I didn't look back for those 6 miles.
Is that pretty high risk?
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause in my mind, I actually had these like visions of other ultra runs that have come down to the wire. One being, last year at one of the races at UTMB, Ultra Trail de Mont Blanc, is this one called TDS. And, it's almost 100 miles, you know, it's just a crazy long ultra.
Mm-hmm.
There are three guys in it with only a 5K to go.
Hmm.
And I remember that, Dylan Bowman, an American, one of my friends, didn't stop at the aid station to get any fuel. He got passed by the two guys who did stop. And so in my mind, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, should I stop to get food? Like, should I stop to get fuel? But I had a little bit of Coke left in one of my saw flasks. Huh. And so I was like, okay, I'm just going to go for it.
For anyone listening, it's Coca-Cola.
Yeah, Coca-Cola. Yeah. Yeah, it was not liquid cocaine. Yeah.
Damn, that's crazy. Okay, yeah. So this is the last 6 miles you said?
Yeah.
Are you just, you're pushing it to the limit for the entire stretch?
Yeah.
And you're blacking out during this?
Basically, I mean, I was running like, I ran a sub 7 minute mile during that. Yeah.
I would be happy just to be walking at that point.
Yeah.
That's
and
crazy.
There's 1,000 foot climb in those last 6 miles. Like it's actually like completely hilarious how not chill those last 6 miles are. And I had forgotten that there was one more aid station around like mile 96.5. Mm. And there my crew was like so dialed and just everyone's losing their minds, right? Everyone's yelling. It's in this really beautiful part of the course called No Hands Bridge. It's this bridge across the American River, and it's covered in lights because it's pitch black at this point, right? Mm. It's the end of the race, and it's covered in lights, and here comes the lead woman, women, plural, and I'm just like, and I was like, get out! My pacer was trying to get me more Coca-Cola, and then I just grabbed another soft flask from my crew with Coke. I downed half of it, and then you know, finished the last 4 miles.
Damn. Yeah. So how far ahead were you at that point, at the last aid station?
I actually put almost two minutes on her in just like 2 miles, which is really kind of significant. Yeah. And I had no idea. Right. I had already put time on her. I just assumed she was 10 feet behind me.
To be separated by 2 minutes over the course of 97 miles, that's like got to be a photo finish in ultra running, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. You ask any of the, you know, the longtime ultra people, supporters, writers, you know, it was arguably one of the best women's races in the history of the race.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's wild. I got goosebumps just listening to you talk about it. Yeah. I know nothing about this sport. That's really cool.
It's not normal. Usually the finishes are pretty boring, to be honest.
So when was that? That race was recent.
Yeah, it was a week ago.
How are you feeling?
Yeah. Honestly, I feel, I feel kind of weird, but happy and grateful. Like my body, I have a few things, you know, this bad Achilles foot thing, but
so how much time do you take off?
I'll take like minimum 2 weeks off from running.
Gotcha.
I take time off pretty seriously after a big race, especially just since I'm still pretty young. Like I'm 27 and that's pretty young in ultra running.
Okay. What is the peak age for an ultra runner?
Like you see women peaking mid-30s even.
Oh.
Like so early 30s, mid-30s. And that's averages, you know. But I mean, you see women winning huge ultras, especially the European women, man, they are so strong. Like in their early 40s even.
Damn.
Yeah.
You've got a lot of races. Yeah. That's wild.
So,
okay. I know we're running up against your upper limit, so I want to save the rest of the time for your environmental activism.
Nice.
So you major in biology at Princeton with a focus on coral reef ecology. How fucked is the Great Barrier Reef?
It's true that pretty much 30% of it is dead. It won't be coming back as we know it. I've never been to the GBR, Great Barrier Reef, but my thesis advisor in college is from Australia and has studied it extensively. And it's so, so sad what's happening to our oceans. Mm-hmm. It's honestly like the most depressing thing you could talk about. the oceans, like the Arctic, are experiencing climate change at a really, really high rate. The oceans are carbon sinks, so they store like most of the CO2 on planet Earth. Like we have a blue planet, and our oceans, the blue that covers this planet, is warming significantly. There's things like ocean acidification that happens from warming, or from just increased CO2 in the atmosphere. And when the ocean gets a little bit more acidic, the corals die. Like, you know, imagine pouring acid on, you know, your breakfast or on your face. Like that's basically what's happening to our coral reefs.
There's no hope of reversing that.
With the GBR and in general, there is hope because certain species will be more resilient than others. They are more resilient than others. So our oceans will change inevitably. They are changing. And it's not to say, you know, the ocean's just going to turn into a black hole. But in terms of the delicacy we think of in like a pristine tropical coral reef, where you have delicate, bright, like sexy, flashy coral with these shiny fish with like tiny features, like that all is like the most fragile of ecosystems. And those like super biodiverse ecosystems we won't have as this worsens. You know, we'll have bigger, more resilient corals that aren't as delicate, and same with the fish. That's because the world's global biodiversity is just going down. We're going to end up with fewer species.
So I've heard that. I know sunscreen is really bad for coral reefs as well. Are there certain brands or chemicals to steer clear of? Because like I'm someone that requires SPF 1000 at all times.
Yeah.
Should I just not go into the ocean?
Yeah,
like,
no,
is there any hope?
Not at all. That's a great question. Yeah. It's the chemical sunscreens that are bad for reefs. So there's two types of sunscreens: a chemical sunscreen, which includes, which basically a chemical reaction happens on your skin, and that's, and then there's a physical barrier sunscreen, and those are easier to remember, and that's what you want to buy. The physical barrier is just like a white barrier over your skin, and that's zinc oxide and titanium dioxide.
Okay,
those are pretty much harmless to reefs and things. But the chemicals, I mean, they're so bad. They're like known carcinogens, oxybenzoin, avobenzene. So honestly, some of the worst brands are Neutrogena, like, because they use heavy chemicals to get high SPFs, and they have a really strong, like, literally, it's like a pharmaceutical lobby in the US. Like, no SPF above 30 is that much greater. Like, SPF basically bottoms out around 30.
In
order to get, like SPF 50 or 80, companies are just adding extra chemicals. So like you're safe with an SPF 30 that's made with zinc oxide and titanium dioxide.
So when you say physical barrier, you mean just like the actual sunscreen that doesn't rub off at all? Like it's just like a, like it's, you're going into the ocean with a white cream that doesn't rub off on water.
Right. Well, it can rub in. Like you don't have to look white.
Okay.
But it's,
I will no matter what.
It's physical, and that's, there's no chemical reaction happening.
Okay.
So the properties in zinc oxide and titanium dioxide, just block the UV rays from touching your skin.
Gotcha.
And so, you know, the classic like white nose lifeguard, that's like pure zinc oxide.
Right.
And today though, we have all these amazing brands of like natural sunscreen that don't make you look like a white nose.
Yeah, sure.
Lifeguard.
Yeah. Powder.
Yeah. So, Hawaii just banned, the bad sunscreens.
Oh,
state
great.
Of Hawaii. So they don't sell them anymore.
That's great.
Yeah. So look at your labels.
Yeah. So I know that's what you studied in college. What environmental causes are you most focused on today?
The biggest and foremost is climate change, which requires like vast government scale action. So in the US, we need our government to act on climate. It's not going to happen from you and my not driving or not taking flights. Like, yes, that's important and, you know, worthy, but we need systematic change, which is going to happen from the shutting down of coal power plants and, you know, increased subsidies. And eventually, you know, the price of wind and solar today is cheaper than coal per kilowatt hour. Like, that's a fact in the US. So we need to stop these ridiculous oil and extraction industry lobbies, and subsidies really of these companies that have been completely screwing over planet Earth and humanity for, you know, the profits of like a handful of executives. And that's what's happening in the Arctic Refuge.
Yeah. So you mentioned systematic changes, which is obviously political. Which 2020 presidential candidate or candidates are you most pulling for from an environmental standpoint?
Yeah, well, I mean, the one candidate who's running on a climate platform, I give him so much credit. He's not doing that well in the polls, but it's Jay Inslee. He's the governor from Washington. And we need, you know, whoever ends up being the Democrat candidate to have a really, really robust climate plan. And so I encourage people to follow things like the Sunrise Movement, which is the grassroots movement behind the Green New Deal, which is a resolution in the House of Reps right now, to get the US to 100% renewable energy. Like, I mean, one, we need to end the regime that's happening right now, which is the Trump administration. And we need that candidate to have a really robust climate action plan. And I encourage people, you know, get involved locally. Like the Senate races around the U.S. are going to be huge in 2020, especially right. in Colorado. Like right. defeating Cory Gardner is a huge need to help prevent more climate change.
Mm-hmm. So we are up against the time that you said you had to stop. Yeah. I did have a couple more environmental things that I have on my list. If you'd rather talk about that or if you actually need to stop, that's totally fine too.
Yeah, you can ask a few more questions. Okay. Yeah, thanks. Okay.
So I do want to talk about the Running Up for Air race series.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Will you please tell us about that?
Yeah. So this is friendly to all hikers even. Yeah, it's actually kind of a perfect event for anyone who wants to get involved with like a climate action event, but via a more fun, active way. And Running Up for Air, also known as RUFA, was started by this guy in Salt Lake City, Jared Campbell, to raise awareness of the awful inversions in Salt Lake City. And that comes from pollution from cars, trucks, and industrial power plants that get stuck in the Salt Lake Valley in the winter months because cold air gets stuck under hot air. And they're awful. Like, it causes asthma, COPD, you know, people like can't breathe outside. And so Jared was like, okay, I'm going to do laps up Grander Peak, which is a mountain overlooking Salt Lake City. And he literally would run through the inversion. So he'd wear a respirator running up until he hit the inversion. Then you get above it when you get to like 9,000 feet. And you can see Salt Lake City just caked in this smog. And of course, he did it for 24 hours, you know, and it raised media awareness because people were like, who is this psychopath running for 24 hours like on this peak? And then it's turned into this really amazing, like, international event, actually. Like, we hosted one, Patagonia Europe hosted one in Chamonix this past spring to raise awareness about the air pollution in the Mont Blanc Valley. Chamonix suffers from similar geography where it's a valley structure, and it gets caked in smog. And it's, you know, so people get out, they do lots of running laps wherever the event may be. There's one in Colorado this year put on by the Suffer Better guys.
Peter Downing,
and Bob Africa. And Colorado, the Denver metro area suffers from really bad ground level ozone, which is happening right now in the summer when heat mixes with pollutants from your cars or trucks. So it's basically a way to talk about these issues that are impacting us and doing something about it, raising money for the nonprofits working for it. And it's fun. You kind of need to add some fun to this, these like heavy, somewhat boring yet like life threatening topics.
So that segues perfectly into my next question. With the robust knowledge that you've got on all these environmental concerns, would you describe yourself as an optimist or a pessimist for the future of our planet?
I think it's definitely an optimist. It's so easy to get depressed. All you have to do is read one article about climate change every day. But I believe that there's a lot of good to be had, and it's motivating to actually do something about it. You know, I think being a pessimist would mean that I've given up and aren't, you know, I don't have my feet on the ground actually doing something about it. So. Mm-hmm.
So doing something about it, if people listening to this, if there's one takeaway, one thing that you could ask everyone listening to this to go do today, what would that be?
It would be to Google HR 1146 and contact your reps about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. This is truly, I feel, ground zero for climate change in America. If we were to allow oil companies drill up there, it would be, I think, one of the worst things we as any human alive today could be a part of, like, to be complicit and to stand by and be idle in the face of like pure evil. It's an easy place to start and pretty concrete, you know.
And I'll follow up with you if there's any specific information that you want included in the show notes. I'll be sure to include that. But
thanks.
Claire, thank you so much for
thanks,
your time.
Zach.
You are really incredible. Congratulations on all the victories and all the victories yet to come.
I'll maybe try my hand at through hiking one of these years.
Yeah, you absolutely should.
Yeah, it's kind of intimidating.
Trust me, it'll be easy compared to what you're doing.
No.
All right. Well, thanks for chatting.
Thank you.
That interview with Claire Gallagher was brought to you by Greenbelly.
In case you're not already familiar, Green Belly is the maker of one of the most complete nutrition bars on the market. Their meals contain 650 calories each, more than 2.5 times the energy of a Clif bar. Think of them like cereal bars on steroids. Because Green Belly meals are ready to eat, requiring no stove or cleanup, they make the perfect midday trail meal. Their meals are super light and made with wholesome ingredients with flavors like peanut apricot, dark chocolate banana, mango cashew coconut, their new flavor, and mine and Chauncey's personal favorite, the cranberry almond. They taste great and are handmade fresh every week. Chauncey and I both love the texture of these bars. They're dense but still soft. They're also not too sweet, which is a nice change of pace in the world of sugary meal replacement bars. And the bars are great for long-distance treks, as the founder, Christopher Cage, is himself a thru-hiker. You may recognize that name from his appearance on the Joe Rogan Experience. And good news for you, our wonderful Backpacker Radio listeners, you get an exclusive 10% discount site-wide at Greenbelly. Just use code TREK10, that's TREK and the number 10, at checkout at their website, greenbelly.co. Don't wait, this deal is only good for a limited time. Okay, back to the show. To the Trek propaganda portion of today's show, today I want to highlight a pair of articles. The first is from Kerry Pattison, one of our 2019 AT bloggers who we featured on the podcast before. Kerry is a star. This piece is titled Power to Petites, Thru-Hiking Tips for Small Women. The subject is probably obvious, so I don't need to say it. And this is, ironically, a robust piece, a bit over 3,500 words and very well written. Kerry is 5'1 and a half herself and features her own advice along with the advice of two other women who are 5'3 and below. The article includes gear, packing, nutrition, and emotional advice along with a few benefits of being a shorter female on the trail. Chauncey will have to weigh in on this one when she returns. Slightly accidental pun there. And the other post I want to highlight is from the Trek's managing editor, a name you've heard many times before, Maggie Slepian. This article goes deep into clothing options specaically for an Appalachian Trail thru-hike. Although attire may look very similar from one trail to the next, the AT has its own unique characteristics, such as soul-crushing humidity, a lot of rain, and the possibility for a separate warm weather gear system. This piece breaks down clothing options piece by piece, covers items that are beloved by some and neglected by others, such as camp shoes and town clothes. The article includes an array of budget-friendly items along with some more technical options. If you're considering an extended haul on the AT, I highly encourage you to check this piece out. And of course, both of these articles will be included in the show notes. Okay, to the iTunes 5-star review portion of the show. This one comes from Pete_G, and it goes, the best backpacking podcast. I'm super stoked to discover Backpacker Radio. Quality interviews with fascinating guests. Chauncey and Zach have a great rapport and complement each other well. I'm working my way through the back catalog while listening to current episodes. It's maddening to wonder if Zach hiked the AT, and based on the YouTube evidence, he stopped the PCT in Stehekin. Well, whatever. At least he sounds like he knows what he's talking about. So that last jab is a reference to the premature end to the 100 days on the PCT video series that Jabba and I were going to do. We do still intend to revive this. However, this is a valid criticism and we have so far dropped the ball badly. Sorry. And on that note, a super big thank you to our Chuck Norris Award winners from Patreon. That includes Christopher Marshburn, S11N, still gotta know what that means, Sawyer Products, Todd Kartner, and Travis Smith. When Chauncey gets back from the AT, we're going to be doing some more unique content specifically for our wonderful Patreon people. We've tossed around the idea of bringing back drunk dialing, which might be more fun for us than you guys, but fun is being had, and this I am sure of. You can keep up with the show on Instagram at Backpacker Radio, on Twitter at Backpacker Pod, Facebook.com/Backpacker Radio. You can follow Claire on Instagram at Claire_Gallagher_runs. You can keep up with me personally at ZR Davis on both Instagram and Twitter. Okay, that's it. Thank you for listening. Happy hiking.
Man, that's it!
Hey, man!
Oh, fighter of the night, man! Oh, champion of the sun! Oh, you're a master of karate and friendship for everyone!